This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Southwest Florida's own award-winning and multifaceted guitarist John Housley joins us in studio upon the release of his new album, The Heart's Furnace. Housley is perhaps best known for his work with the multi-platinum southern rock band Blackfoot and performs with the highly popular Southwest Florida-based band A200. But this new album explores a whole other side to his musical talents and interests. The new album features classical guitar songs in the Nuevo Flamenco style. We'll talk with John about his musical journey and hear selections from the new album. That's coming up later this hour. But first, we're joined in studio now by legendary animator and director Ron Campbell, who comes to Naples for a series of rare public appearances at an art exhibition of his work at HW Gallery. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' classic animated film Yellow Submarine. Campbell was one of the animators behind the musical fantasy comedy film and also its director. The Yellow Submarine film will be re-released in theaters for a limited engagement this July in celebration. The Emmy-nominated artist also directed the Saturday morning Beatles cartoon series in the 60s and lent his talents to countless other classic children's animation programs over his 50-year career, including Sesame Street, Yogi Bear, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?, The Flintstones, The Jetsons, The Smurfs, The Snorks, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Winnie the Pooh, DuckTales, and Rugrats, and that's literally just naming a few. Campbell will make public appearances at the HW Gallery this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday as the gallery showcases his original Beatles cartoon paintings created for the show. Campbell will also be creating new Beatles pop art paintings at the exhibition. Ron Campbell, you know, I can't say enough about how your work has shaped mine and countless other people's childhoods more than any of us really ever knew. Welcome so much to Gulf Coast Live, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
It's my pleasure to be here, John. Thank you very much for that fulsome introduction, but I must make one correction.
Yes, sir.
I directed the Beatles television cartoon show, but I did not direct the Yellow Submarine. I animated many scenes in the Yellow Submarine, but I was in Hollywood doing my work. The film was being made in London, and they shipped scenes to me to Hollywood to animate, and I would do pencil drawings and ship the pencil drawings back to England, where they would ink and paint and film the scenes.
Interesting. So, well, thank you so much for that correction. I apologize. And listeners can join our conversation and connect with Ron Campbell as well with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. And to start off, I just wanted to ask a little bit about what your life is like now in light of the 50th anniversary celebration of the iconic Yellow Submarine film. Are you doing a lot of these kind of gallery appearances and
traveling? Yes, I am, and thank heavens for that. I mean, I'm approaching 80 years old now, and if I had to sit at home watching the Golf Channel or something, I'd be dying. But it keeps me alive, and I'm very, very happy about it. And the reception that the public gives my artwork is very, very pleasant.
Well, take us back to the days when you were still working on the Saturday morning Beatles cartoon series. Mm-hmm. You were still in Australia at that time.
Sure. I'd grown up in Australia watching American cartoons in the movie theaters. And the very idea that I could do drawings that could appear to come alive and actually make me fall in the aisle laughing like Tom and Jerry and Heckle and Jekyll, just sort of captured my young imagination. And I went through art school. There was no way to earn a living doing animation in Australia through most of my youth. But then television arrived, and with television came a demand for TV commercials, and with TV commercials came a demand for animation for the first time. So there I was, just on the leading edge of animation in Australia, doing television commercials. And as a result, found myself working on American TV shows with King Features, doing Popeye and Beetle Bailey and Crazy Cat, which I love. Everybody listening should check out Crazy Cat comic strips from 1920 and 1930. Wonderful comic strip. So when the time came for the Beatles King Features had sold the idea of the Beatles immediately after the Ed Sullivan Show, where the Beatles played in America and drove all the little girls wild. Mm-hmm. And when they agreed to do a cartoon show, Al Brodax called me and said, "Ron, we've just sold a new TV show, and we'd like you to direct the episodes we're going to produce in Australia, maybe as much as half of the show." I said, "Great, Al, what's the show?" And he said, "It's Beatles." I said, "Beatles? Insects make terrible characters for a cartoon show, Al. What are you doing?" He said, "No, no, it's the Rock and Roll Group." Rock and Roll Group, and stupid me, I'd barely heard of them at that point. Peripherally, I'd heard about it, but it didn't compute. I was too busy learning how to make cartoons and deliver on time and under budget, you know. So anyway, I was swiftly corrected, and then I actually managed to listen to the Beatles, and my God, these kids are good. You know?
Well, I was surprised to learn that throughout the whole process of you know, working on both the television series and the film,
right,
you didn't actually meet the band.
No, I didn't. I was always on the other side of the world. I was always in the wrong place. My work that I did on the Yellow Submarine, I was in Hollywood, unable to leave the country because in those days I was in the process of getting my green card to be able to become an American citizen. And in those days, if you left the country while in that process, you had to start all over again, you know. And I might have been stuck in England, not that that's a fate worse than death. But anyway, it was impossible for me to leave the country. So I had to stay in Hollywood. And the Beatles were in London and in India during the production. And right. They really had nothing to do with the making of the film except the most important part, which was giving us the music, of course.
Right, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you or even other members of your creative team, you know, even indirectly have some contact with them?
Yeah. Everybody in England did. Okay. I mean, they came around to the studio several times, look over animators' shoulders and, gee, that doesn't look like me, you know, make remarks. When we did the Saturday morning cartoon, I was in Sydney and the Beatles were in London, except when they went to do shows in Europe. And Ringo, when they went and saw the show for the very first time, was heard to say as they came out of the screening room, "They made me the idiot." And of course, we had any group of four has to have a leader and a lover boy and a winsome, sophisticate, mystic,
and an
idiot.
A mark. Yeah.
Right. Poor Ringo fell into the idiot role. He's no idiot, of course, in real life. But you know, we were only very roughly emulating the way the Beatles. Well. The Beatles put out a certain personality. Each had their own personality, and we just copied it. Except Ringo wasn't quite the idiot that you know that he put out.
Yeah. And you know, I think probably a big part of why you know the 50th anniversary of the Yellow Submarine film is so important. You know, aside from the film itself, is just the staying power of their music. You know, each successive generation.
Jesus.
I mean, kids just coming of age today are far in the rear view of you know Beatlemania days are discovering and identifying with the music.
It is incredible, actually. Very few musicians come around in a century to make an indelible mark in music of their own century. You know, there's Mozart, there's Brahms. I mean, dare you compare them to such masters? Of course, because I'm personally convinced 200 years from now, people will be thinking of 20th century music, and amongst the greats of the 20th century are going to be the Beatles, no question about it.
Well, the same way we listen to classical composers today.
Yeah. They'll be, to them, our equivalent of Mozart, you know. Yes. That's my view of it anyway.
Well, take us back to your early days as an emerging artist. I mean, did you grow up in a home where that kind of creativity was fostered? Did your, you know, family encourage you to develop those talents?
Well, I grew up in a loving home, a lot of affection, and very Australian. But there wasn't the slightest hint of any artistic ambitions in the house. But I must also say, for some mysterious reason, I've observed adults when they have children, if a child does exhibit artistic interests above the ordinary or the average, adults get quite flustered and pleased about it, you know.
Sure.
And I do have many memories of being enormously flattered by all the adults around me when I would draw. And I guess that when I think back on it, that might have had something to do with the fact that I followed an artistic bent. Although I don't really see myself as an artist, actually. All I do is cartoons, you know. My very best friend became a very, very prominent and successful painter in Australia, Jan Sandbergs. And I consider what he does art. What I do is fun. That's all.
You did study art formerly in
Melbourne.
Oh, yeah.
I went to art school. I went to a damn fine art school and a great college, Swinburne Institute. Everybody in Australia knows Swinburne, like everybody in America knows, Harvard, you know. But it's an elite school. It was a very good school. I remember my school days with great affection.
Was it when you were studying art that you kind of found, you know, the cartoon genre, or were you already doing that?
Oh, no. I found the cartoon genre when I was like 7 years old going to the movies, you know. And my great-grandmother told me when I told her about it, I could, you know, we'd see a cowboy movie afterwards, and that would be like normal people running around. But then these Tom and Jerry, this cat and mouse, would be chasing each other. And they weren't normal people, you know, but where were they? In real life, I never saw such things, you know, and I was very mystified by it. And I thought perhaps there really was a cat and a mouse running around behind the screen, or the beam of light that came down on it from behind me onto the screen didn't figure in my calculations at all. And I remember vividly to my great-grandmother telling her about it and asking her, where were these animals? And she told me that, no, Ronnie, they're just drawings. And it hit me like an epiphany, a childish stroke from the blue. What? Drawings? You mean my drawings can come alive? Yes, Ronnie.
And boy, did they.
And boy. Oh, man. For the rest of my life, I've been doing the damn things.
So you come to the U.S. in 66. You're in Hollywood.
Yes, I did in 66. You've been checking me up.
Huh? I have.
There's no privacy anywhere anymore.
No, especially not with the internet. So you're working on the Beatles film, and simultaneously you're one of the creators of Scooby-Doo.
Well, I did work on the early development of the show, the very, very early development of the show, actually. And so while I was animating scenes for the Yellow Submarine, I was – by that time the show had been purchased – by the network, CBS, was it? Memory fades. And they needed storyboards for the opening sequences and the opening episodes, the early episodes. So for that first year, I was doing storyboards for Scooby-Doo. And in the evenings, I was animating scenes for George of the Jungle and Tom Slick and
I've had that
Super
theme song
Chicken
running through my head all
George,
week.
George of the Jungle, watch out for that tree. Yeah, so I was a very busy boy. My wife had inconveniently got pregnant, as wives sometimes do. And, you know, we'd only been in America 1 year, and we were still struggling to find suitable housing and all kinds of things. And establish ourselves in this strange country called the United States of America. And so she got pregnant as we were living out of a suitcase, you know. I always tease her about that.
Well, and Scooby-Doo's character himself, I was kind of surprised to learn, because he has that, like, you know, very distinguishable way of speaking. Ruh-roh, Shaggy.
Right.
But it wasn't just for the humor factor. There was
no. There's a story behind that. There's a reason why Scooby-Doo can barely talk, but he can talk and seems to understand everything you say. That came from. That came from an admonition of a child psychologist who explained to us very early in the development of the show that if you think about it and you've raised some children, you know and recognize that a child learns to speak whatever language their parents speak by listening to them, and they can understand what's being said to them. Pretty much. I mean, it happens first you understand what the words mean, then you have to learn how to control your voice box and your larynx or whatever, all the organs that are necessary, the breathing, to pronounce the words that you already understand the meaning of. Mm. So if Scooby could struggle to pronounce the words he already knows the meaning of, Scooby will find himself identified with by the children who are watching the TV show. They will recognize what Scooby is going through because they had just been going through it themselves, and will empathize more readily with the dog. And they will not only empathize but see themselves in the dog. And for that reason, they are actually forced to love the dog like they love themselves. So if you watched Scooby-Doo as a small child, I can assure you that you have been manipulated.
Oh, I certainly have then, yes. Well, and again, there's just so many cartoons that you've had a hand in lending your talents to. And I'm wondering if, you know, are there any that you just have a particular affinity or a soft spot for like above all others?
I've been very lucky in my life to always be able to work on shows that I had great respect for, and if I did not have a great respect for it, I was lucky enough to be able to stop working on the show and go and do something else for the most part. So it's impossible to say one is more affectionate in my memory than others, except I can say there is one show that I'm proudest of, and that was my own show, The Big Blue Marble, which won a Peabody and an Emmy and Action for Children's Television Awards and went worldwide. So I'm very proud of The Big Blue Marble. It was a wonderful show, and if you watched it as a child, you probably agreed. Many people have come to me and said they remember the show, but many people never saw it. It was on PBS sometimes in some markets, and in other markets it was syndicated. And so, yeah, The Big Blue Marble is my proudest work, but I loved them all.
Yeah. What about the environments of working for these different, you know, studio powerhouses like Hanna-Barbera and Disney mm-hmm. Animation? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there significant differences in, I guess, those work environments or what they expected from you?
No, not significant, but there were differences. I can't put my finger on it exactly, but Disney was so much more full of itself and had a lot more money than Hanna-Barbera production. But Hanna-Barbera, I deeply admired Bill Hanna especially. He was a production man. I tried to emulate him. He was like a father figure to me in some respects. Joe Barbera I greatly admired. He was a very talented man. He could jump up on a desk and act out the part of a Tom and Jerry cartoon. Funny guy, you know. I don't think I could explain the differences in the studios. Mostly, though, it was my studio that was doing subcontract work for both those studios. So when I wasn't producing my own show like the Big Blue Marble, I was subcontracting shows for both of those companies. Bill Hanna, my studio was across the road from Hanna-Barbera, and Bill Hanna would, when he'd tearing his hair out trying to get certain production done, he would send a show over to my studio across the road, and my staff would make the film.
And I know your work is involved, you know, both animation, you know, actually drawing, but then also sometimes storyboarding. Can you maybe tell us about the difference, just for folks who maybe don't know the industry that well?
Oh, well,
like myself.
You know, when you make something, you have a production line. You make a car, you have a production line. You build a house, you have stages of production. And when you make a cartoon film for television, you have stages of production. Well, if you're going to build a house, for example, you need architect's plans so that the plumber knows where the pipes go. And in the building of that house, everybody refers to the blueprints, you know, for the building of that house, whatever job they're doing. Well, a storyboard is the exact comparable thing to a blueprint for the building of a house. It shows everything that's going to happen pretty much for the making of the cartoon film. It'll show whether this scene is in a close-up or a long shot, or how the characters are acting, etc. So that's what the storyboard is. It looks very much like a comic strip with a lot of writing all over the drawings, a lot of indicators of emotions of the characters, or descriptions of the color of a background or the color outside a door. It'll have all kinds of information on it. That's the storyboard. And there's another stage of directing in film, in cartoon film, that times everything out, how long a specific action should have, and that's called sheet direction. So as I say, there's different stages of production. The producer would hire the storyboard artist, and the director would take the storyboard and time out the action, and the animator would animate it, and the assistant animator would do all the in-betweens. The ink and paint would transfer everything onto acetate cells, we call them, and the background artist would paint the backgrounds, etc.
I'm thinking about it. I've been thinking about it all week, just how your work influenced my life growing up. You know, Monday through Friday, you couldn't drag me out of bed to go to school.
Don't blame me.
Well, I just mean, like, Saturday morning, you know, I'm up at 6 a.m. It's Saturday morning cartoons. And then you knew it was all over when Soul Train came on. And then it was the afternoon. But did you yourself have that kind of childhood experience?
I knew that was going on all over America. Mm-hmm. But we didn't think about it too much. I know, you know, the children were rushing down the stairs yelling, "Get out the cereal boxes, you know, it's Saturday," you know, and watching cartoons. It was a great time for kids. It's a shame now the spoiled brats of today have cartoons 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Yeah, with the Cartoon Network now.
Yeah, you know, not just one either. There's, you know, Nickelodeon and Cartoon, and there was Boomerang and other. Yeah, so I'm not responsible for your ill-spent youth.
Very well.
I refuse to accept responsibility for that.
Very well. And you know, over the span of your 50-year career, you know, I imagine there was, you know, a great deal of changes just in terms of technology and how that impacted.
Well, yeah, there was. But at the very beginning, the most remarkable thing about it was. See if I can explain this quickly. Chuck Jones was a wonderful director in the generation before me. He was making wonderful cartoons for cinema. He had to make a 7-minute film, and he had a budget of $50,000. Now, when we were doing the Beatles TV cartoon show, we had a half-hour film. It was 22 minutes long, actually, and we had a budget of like $5,000, okay? Now, Chuck Jones had 7 minutes of film to make and $50,000. We had 22 minutes, not seven, 22, and we had $5,000, not $50,000,
right.
Okay? So it required a totally different approach to making the cartoon. Had to minimize pencil mileage, what we called pencil mileage, down to an absolute minimum. And if you watch the cartoons of the Beatles TV cartoons, you will see that there will be a held body and eight drawings of legs going, you know, that would go on forever. And so the cost could be controlled. So from that, and nobody really knew how to make money out of children's television in 1961. We can put all this money in making of the production, and how do we get our money back? Well, there'll be some advertising, I suppose. Well, we'd better have an advertiser. Well, we would have little toy train manufacturer advertise on TV, and the income would be very small. So over the years, the biggest change that occurred was the fact that the budgets as people made money, as the networks made money, as everybody started making money, more money was devoted to production until finally we get to Disney in the 90s spending enormous sums on television cartoons. And the concomitant change in quality was obvious and clear to see. Though not necessarily the entertainment value changed all that much, because clearly the very, very cheaply produced Beatles cartoons, for example, had a huge, huge rating. It was like a 67 share. Yeah. Out of every 100 TV sets turned on at that moment, 67 of them are watching the Beatles TV cartoon show. And there are TV producers today that would murder their grandmother for a tenth of that rating.
Yeah. What are your thoughts now with, you know, we see so much, you know, CGI. It seems like a lot of animation is almost fully digital today.
Yes, it is. And it works marvelously. However, I know absolutely nothing about it. If I were a young man today, I would not be interested at all in sitting in front of a computer for the rest of my life moving digital dots around. You know? No, it's not. Wouldn't have interested me at all. But it does – it can do things that no human being can do. On the other hand, computers can't do what human beings can do either.
Right.
I like the animation, hand-drawn animation. I just do. It's just nicer.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit about what folks who come to your exhibition in Naples in the next few days are going to experience. What sort of works are you including?
Sure. Well, I'll have about 50 or 60 paintings up on the wall, and everything will be for sale. The prices will range from $300 to nearly $10,000. Most of it will be under $1,000. It will be paintings based on cartoons that I've made. If you ask me to do a drawing of, say, Bugs Bunny, I could do it, but I won't do it. I only do drawings based on cartoons that I worked on. And also, there, when you buy a piece, I do a certificate of authenticity, and on that certificate I will do drawings. So if you bought a Flintstones, I could do drawings of Scooby-Doo or, you know... So and people seem to love that. I don't know why. It's just a little doodle to me with a paintbrush, but they go ape over it sometimes. Sometimes I even get people crying because of the nostalgia that they experience overwhelms them, and I can yell out, "We got a crier here! We got a crier here!" You know, that happens more than you would think, you know. And it's all nostalgia, you know. It's, everybody has a childhood. Some people have very bad childhood. But even those with very bad childhoods, memories, have a happy moment to remember when they were watching cartoons.
You know? And it can really – it kind of connects us all together if we came from a particular generation.
It does. If you're an American or an Australian, you're a victim of the art of cartooning.
Well, I'm
a victim.
I'm a happy victim. But
that's part of your fundamental culture, I guess.
Yes. Well, Ron Campbell, I'm sorry that we're out of time for this portion of the show, but it has been my distinct pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It was my pleasure, John.
And you can catch Campbell. He will be at the HW Gallery in Naples from 4 to 8 tomorrow, then on Saturday from noon to 6, and on Sunday from noon to 4. And again, Ron Campbell, such a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're taking a quick break, but when we return, Southwest Florida's own incredible guitar talent, John Housley, is live in studio. We'll learn all about his life and music and hear selections from his new album, The Heart's Furnace, which features classical music songs in the Nuevo Flamenco style. That's just ahead. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. Stay with us.